Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network podcast on animal studies. I'm Akash Andachi, host of the channel, and I'm joined today by Dr. Marissa Bass. We'll speak about her book, Insect Artifice, Nature and Art in the Dutch Revolt, published by Princeton University Press in 2019. Dr. Bass is Associate Professor of Northern European Art at Yale University. Dr. Bass, it's a pleasure. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Akash. It's a pleasure to be here.
I think it would be beneficial for our listeners if we began our discussion by introducing Joris Hoefnagel, but I would like to touch on a clarification you make early on in the book, namely that while the study is anchored by Hoefnagel and the Four Seasons, this is not a monograph. Rather, the artist and his oeuvre channel a larger world of thought and experience, and at this time in the Netherlands, there was an impulse to counter the destruction of war through a productive fever of scribbling, versifying, and chronicling. I thus wondered if you could present Hoefnagel in context of the geopolitics of his age and what you refer to as the plights and pursuits of many of his contemporaries.
Absolutely. That's a great first question. I first want to say that, you know, I came to the study of this artist, Joris Hoefnagel, who was born in Antwerp in what is now Belgium in 1542. He died in 1600, so sort of right on the edge of the 17th century. I first came to him because he is the maker of incredibly beautiful art. And this book is really meant at its heart to foreground the incredible miniatures that he produced in watercolor and gouache and gold over the course of his life as an essentially self-taught artist. And that aim is then combined with a larger aim that is reflected in the title of the book, Nature and Art in the Dutch Revolt, to understand Hoefnagel as a witness to his times and to sort of understand what compelled him to make these incredibly beautiful, delicate, meticulous miniatures of the natural world. And to answer that question, I had to think about what was going on in his moment. And Hoefnagel, as I said, was born in Antwerp. He was born to a merchant family. And he, as a result, was educated, as was common for the sort of upper echelons of the mercantile world in Antwerp, sent to university in France. So here's somebody who comes from a commercial background, who has an education that not everyone in his time would have had, certainly not most artists. He enters the world in an era of prosperity for the Netherlands, the region where he was born. And he sees his world shift completely, not unlike the kind of shift we're seeing in the world around us today, a shift that happens because of religious strife. So this is the moment when Protestantism is really taking hold in the Netherlands. This upsets King Philip II, who is the ruler of Spain and who through his sort of Habsburg lineage had come to be the ruler of the Netherlands as well, who is staunchly Catholic. And meanwhile, the Netherlands is sort of has this mounting interest in Protestantism. It's being ruled by this Catholic king from afar who doesn't even speak their language. The Netherlands is not a place that is used to imperial rule whatsoever. So suddenly, the kind of Philip's attempt to curb Protestantism in the Low Countries results in him sending troops to the region, trying to, prosecute what he understands to be heretical faith. This upsets the economy. It upsets the sort of political norms of the region. And this is what Hufnagel is living through early in his career. And a crucial aspect of that is that art itself is under threat because radical Protestants believe that the Catholics are corrupt, not only in their ideology, but also in their emphasis on the materiality of religion. And the Netherlands is full of incredibly beautiful altarpieces, sculptures that were produced over the course of its Catholic history that get attacked in events of iconoclasm, especially in the year 1566. Again, so now we can imagine Hufnagel in his early 20s, this merchant seeing the kind of cultural heritage that he's grown up with sort of destroyed and questioned before his eyes. All the while sort of being someone who's engaging with art on the side. So it's the story of a person who's really a polymath, who's a reader, who's a maker of images, who's a merchant, so who understands the world through all these different lenses, also somebody who travels very widely because of his mercantile career. And that's something we can come back to, Akash, when we look at talk a little bit more about his art in particular, who sees his world utterly changed within the space of a few years. And the breaking point is really in 1576, when Spanish troops are have been occupying Antwerp for some time, trying to keep the peace. And they're frustrated because they're not being paid by the Spanish. And so they mutiny and they start plundering the city of Antwerp and targeting wealthy mercantile families like Hufnagel's. And his entire family fortune, according to our earliest sort of biographical source on Hufnagel, is taken by the Spanish. And at this point, it's really a kind of That's the end point for Hufnagel in terms of his life in Antwerp. And he becomes one of many individuals in the creative and cultural world of Antwerp who flee the city and go elsewhere in Europe. And his travels take him to Italy. They take him to the courts of Germany, where suddenly he begins the second career as an artist because of the astonishingly beautiful miniatures are represented in my book, and eventually ends up at the court of Prague in Vienna, where he works in his final years for one of the greatest patrons of the late 16th, early 17th century, the Emperor Rudolf II. So this is a really sort of complicated trajectory, and it's one of the things that makes Hufnagel an incredible witness, not just to nature, but to a moment of radical upheaval in early modern Europe. And so the book is kind of layered around at its center, these beautiful works of art that represent a kind of early engagement with, what we would now understand to be natural history and biology. And those are, embraced by the kind of story that we can unfold by following Hufnagel's career and trajectory and the kind of networks, both politically and culturally, in which he participated.
Thank you for explaining that. I'd like to maybe now turn a little bit to some of these works. And at many points throughout the book, we're reminded of how superficially small things can hold immense meanings. And chapter one discusses Hufnagel's literary and visual mottos in this regard and looks to the significance of inscriptions in the margins. And later on, you mention how images raise questions far better than they give answers. And in speaking of images as instruments, note that they were employed in conjunction with other arts, such as written scholarship. Could you discuss Hufnagel's mediums, namely miniatures, and their relation to his study of the natural world and insects in particular?
Absolutely. So first, I want to try to sort of help our listeners understand what these miniatures look like. So you have to imagine holding in your hands books on delicate parchment, books that are really designed to be held in the hand. So a kind of book that's the size you could read in bed, like a paperback novel today, except made out of this costly material and painted each miniature, in the Four Elements manuscripts that are the sort of centerpiece of Hufnagel's career and the manuscripts that he works on across the whole period of his life from, you know, the moment of upheaval in Antwerp that I was just discussing until his death. So you open these volumes and you see these ovals that are painted in gold, and inside of them are representations of animals from the kind of four elemental kingdoms. So you have a book of mammals, you have a book with reptiles, you also have a book of fish and sea creatures, and you have a book of birds, and then a book of insects under the category of fire, which is an interesting classification that we can maybe talk about later. And so within the ovals, you have these depictions of these animals and insects, also plants, seashells, and they're depicted with, you know, the tiniest brush in watercolor and gouache that is carefully layered. You see sort of almost no imperfection in some of the representations of insects. There are even actual insect wings that Hufnagel pasted to the page. And then alongside those pasted wings would paint his own representation of a wing of the same insect species, which is a kind of tour de force way of getting us to think about, you know, to what extent an artist can get so close to this kind of exacting representation of nature. And the animals and the insects and the fishes and the birds, but particularly the insects, are represented on the page sometimes in very elaborate compositions, sometimes in landscapes, sometimes as isolated specimens on the page that are arranged in sort of symmetries or, you know, relationships, sometimes almost as even if they're talking to each other. And then framing these very delicate miniatures are texts, Latin texts. There are almost over 1,000 Latin texts across the four volumes of the Four Elements alone. And this is only one of the manuscripts that Hufnagel illuminated over the course of his career. And these texts refer to passages from the Bible. They refer to classical sources. They refer to contemporary sources. Some of them are poems written by Hufnagel's friends. And all of these are done in Hufnagel's hand and his very sort of careful handwriting. So the experience, the material experience of Hufnagel's works is one of incredible attention. You sort of feel the attention and the labor on the part of the artist. And they also command one's attention. They immediately register as images that you can't understand immediately, that you have to sit with. You sort of have to hold them, hold these volumes in your hand and think with them. And that's really crucial to, you know, the quote that you gave, Akash, about, you know, that images provide questions far better than they give answers. It's not an intuitive idea for us, you know, in our present moment, coming from the perspective of how we think of scientific illustration, which is as diagrammatic. So when we look at a scientific illustration, say, an anatomical diagram in Gray's Anatomy, that image is meant to provide information to us about a part of a body, and it will be meticulously labeled. And it's meant to provide an answer to what is this muscle? What is this ligament? You know, what is this vein? And that's not the kind of image that Hufnagel made. So even though his miniatures unfold and contain an incredible body of knowledge about the animal and insect kingdoms, and show, particularly in the case of the birds and the insects, his close attention to study of these creatures from the life, many of which had not been studied before. So even though they embed all of this information, they are not labeled, this is, you know, a scarab beetle and this is a cricket beetle. They are not presented, the visual material is not presented in such a way that we're meant to think of it as something that we use to answer a question. On the contrary, the relationship between the text and image in these volumes is meant to open up questions and associations for us about how we relate to the natural world, how we understand what it means to be human relative to the animal. This kind of complex relationality that is, you know, something that is part of sort of contemporary theory about human-animal relationships today, but is already very strongly there in Hufnagel's way of thinking with the animal world. So it's important to think about that text image relationship too for Hufnagel's personal mottos that you mentioned, because he was also someone who was very clever, a very sort of punning, witty fellow. And he devised several personal mottos over the course of his career that speak to this idea of himself not as this kind of all-knowing, you know, encyclopedic mind, but as somebody who was really a searching mind, someone who is really trying to understand his place in the world. And the sort of epitome of this is his motto in Latin, Natura sola magistra, which means nature, his only teacher. And that really encompasses the way that he thought with the animal world, which is that he is learning from nature rather than taking the position of being someone who is an expert on nature and explaining it to us.
I have to say to our listeners that this is definitely one of those books that it's such a pleasure to read it. And I can say that without any reservations, but it's also the images are wonderful. And to uncover them as you read, it's you've laid them out beautifully and right in the centerfold. And it's they're these gorgeous miniatures. And now you did just touch upon Hufnagel's wit and his personality. And if we could turn for a minute to his own being and what makes him kind of unique as an artist and in this context, building on his unique approach to the study of the natural world, I wonder if we could discuss how he positioned himself in relation to nature when compared to some of his influences mentioned in the book, such as Conrad Gessner. Hufnagel seems to position himself at more of a distance from his animal subjects and communicates his findings with slightly more nuance and less of an intent to distill or own or master the natural world. And the meaning that he does derive from nature and which he communicates through his works suggests a more personal relationship as well. It is noted at one point that some of his miniatures and drawings could truly belong to nobody except their intended recipient. Could you expand upon who the four elements were intended for and how Hufnagel drew upon the natural world and its animals to portray his own history?
Yes, that's a great question, Akash. And I should also say, you know, that I do think that the reason to the appeal of the book is so much about the kind of full the full page facsimiles at the center of the volume, and I can take no credit for that. I wholly credit my publisher and editor at Princeton University Press for making this such a beautiful book. It wouldn't work without the images. So I think there are several layers to your question. One is sort of Hufnagel's relationship with nature relative to other scholars and thinkers who engage with nature in his 16th century moment. And you mentioned Conrad Gessner, who is sort of understood to be the father of natural history in many ways. And beginning in 1551, he started to publish this multi-volume work called The History of Animals that is remarkable in its sort of encyclopedic nature. So you read an entry on the cow and you will read a description of the cow and of its habitat. And then you will read about all of these kind of, all the sayings associated with the cow since antiquity and sort of adages and ways of understanding the cow, maybe references to the cow in the Bible. So it extends much beyond what we would think of being part of a kind of description or classificatory description of an animal. And Gessner really cared about images too. So this is important for Hufnagel because Gessner's treatises are illustrated with woodcut prints, woodcut being a medium that allowed for the the greatest number of good reproductions of the images within a volume that was going to be widely circulated. And that's not to say that everybody could afford to buy Conrad Gesner's History of Animals in the 16th century, because it's a large book and it would have been expensive. But enough people were able to purchase it that it really made an impact. And Gesner had grand plans. He wanted to do a volume on insects too, but he unfortunately died of the plague in 1565 and left a pile of drawings and notes for other people to sort of wade through over the subsequent centuries. And so Gesner, and I would add to that another great sort of naturalist and student of nature in Italy, Ulisse Aldrovandi, who was based in Bologna. Both Gesner and Aldrovandi were people who had what they described as museums that were filled with notes, but also particularly images that they collected. Maybe some that they made themselves, maybe some made that they commissioned, others sent to them, or that they collected from other artists representing the animals in the world. And their goal was really to publish these in printed books and disseminate them to a wide audience. Hufnagel benefited from such publications immensely, and he, in fact, particularly in the volumes of the Four Elements devoted to animals and birds and fishes, he relied on such printed images as his models and sort of represented them in his own compositions and in color. As I've already mentioned, he didn't always do that. When there were no models, he represented something on his own and for the first time. So it's interesting to see him drawing on this tradition, but at the same time, his aim isn't totally different, because he chose to use the medium of manuscript. And when you're making manuscripts in an era of print, so this is a moment when books are being widely published, individual prints are being sold everywhere, there's a market for them. His choice to make a manuscript is really interesting. And this is one of the places we can see his project of image making tie back to the political context of his time, because once again, Hufnagel witnessed this era of Inquisition where people were being persecuted for their religious beliefs in his hometown of Antwerp. And also anyone found to have any images that might be understood to be heretical were also persecuted. So he had this idea of manuscript as a kind of private space, a kind of space for intellectual and interpersonal exchange. And that is really the profound difference between his works and those of the natural historians like Gesner, who were really trying to get their information published and out in the kind of pan-European milieu. That also impacts the nature of the images that Hufnagel makes. So he may borrow a representation of a monkey from Gesner, but then what he does with that monkey is so profoundly different. So once again, rather than sort of labeling the monkey and saying this is such and such a species, this is where it lives, he's associating the monkey with ideas of imitation or mimicry, with playfulness, with sort of characteristics and qualities that are also associated with humankind. So the question he's always asking is, what can we learn from looking at this animal about ourselves or about the kind of complex moment that we live in when so much is changing? And that is really fundamental too to understanding who would have seen these incredibly meticulous manuscripts and stunning manuscripts that Hufnagel spent, you know, as it seems, almost three decades of his life producing. Who would have seen these things? Who was he making them for? And it's really, you know, if we sort of step back and think about the history of art history, the field in which I write and teach, it's really striking that art history almost always sort of wants to deal with things that are big, things that are in the public eye. If you go, you know, a traditional survey of art history is going to give you big, major paintings and sculptures and buildings, that have a huge impact. It's going to give you very little in the way of the kind of art that Hufnagel made, delicate miniatures on paper or parchment. But these are works, too, that had an audience that was really intentional. And in a way, these works, even though they're private and were probably seen by only a few of Hufnagel's closest friends with whom he was corresponding, even from abroad, with whom he was exchanging images and also commissioning them to write little poems for these manuscripts. That seems to have been the primary audience for these works. It's really meant for him and for his colleagues who are trying to understand their particular moment. And once we see that they're thought spaces, they are just as valuable for understanding the historical moment in which they were made as, you know, a monumental painting made for a public building at the same time, or a monumental painting made for one of the courts in which Hufnagel was employed. So one way I describe the manuscripts is as, you know, in terms of their potentially broader public, is that these private sort of interpersonal manuscripts that he shared with friends who also had fled Antwerp, or even some who had stayed and were trying to weather the kind of crisis of the moment. They also served as a kind of calling card for Hufnagel when he was traveling abroad to sort of demonstrate his ability as an artist. So the other people we can imagine who may have seen these manuscripts would have been the patrons who ended up hiring him. And of course, they saw these very elaborate manuscripts and they didn't see a thought space. They said, oh my gosh, this guy can make incredible miniatures. I want him to illuminate something for me. And then he illuminated prayer books and calligraphic manuscripts for them that were not so sort of discursive as The Four Elements, which is a project that was sort of his own creation and, stemmed from his own intentionality. They're much more sort of expressly virtuosic. They're much more sort of oriented toward complementing and affirming the kind of status and perceived, you know, and knowledge of their elite patrons. So another thing that we can see across Hufnagel's larger oeuvre is his awareness of audience, his sort of deftness at navigating a difficult sort of cultural moment and a difficult life, you know, because he had to keep moving throughout his life by responding to different audiences. And the last point with that is, in fact, that his son, Jakob Hufnagel, was also an artist, and toward the end of his father's life, produced a series of prints published in 1591, called Archetypes and Studies After His Father, in which he published in print some of the most sort of notable representations of insects that his father had produced over the course of his career. And those prints were extremely popular because they disseminated now not just to patrons and patrons in the courtly context, but also to artists and even to natural historians, really incredible and unprecedented models for representing animals and insects in particular. So this is obviously something that Joris Hufnagel, Joris the father, sanctioned because he also understood that he'd created something that other people wanted to see. So we have these kind of different arenas in which he operated, but it begins from this very sort of private and personal space of reflection and self-reflection.
It's fascinating. And some of these calling cards and the thought spaces that he's created with colleagues and people that are sharing some of his experiences, they at times form these allegorical representations of their experiences, kind of demonstrated through these animal characters. I'm thinking of these Monument of Friendship drawings that you include, or there's a prayer inscription above a depiction of Antwerp that he makes that reads, I'm become a sparrow all alone on the housetop. I was wondering if you uncovered anything during your research regarding Hufnagel's attitude towards human-animal hierarchies or human exceptionalism, perhaps?
That's a great question. I first of all, my absolute favorite works by Hufnagel are these works that he called monuments of friendship. I think it's a genre that we should revive. And it's such a counterintuitive for us, especially in the present moment, way to think about what a monument is, because these monuments of friendship were not large and monumental. They are works on parchment, very delicate. So delicate, in fact, that Hufnagel would paste them to pieces of wood before he sent them to his friends in the mail to ensure that they didn't get bent or damaged and that they would be preserved over time. And these are really beautiful representations of animals and insects, often posed in dialogue, and precisely, Akash, as you say, with sort of allegories about knowledge and sort of using nature to combat ignorance. So understanding nature is a means both to get closer to God, to understand one's place in the larger cosmos, and to achieve humility relative to the larger cosmos, and also to take refuge from the kind of troubles of this moment, again, of so much trouble and uncertainty that was surrounding him. And again, you know, these are objects, they're really objects that you could hold in your hand. And the idea of a monument of friendship being something that Hufnagel labored over and made to send to his friend from afar. And some of these we know were sent to people who Hufnagel never saw again. They died before he would ever see them again. So it's almost like he's giving himself, sending a piece of himself with these monuments of friendship to his friends who are now far away. So there's that idea of, you know, targeted allegory is really interesting. Also interesting is that among his friends and colleagues with whom he was exchanging these drawings and miniatures are other scholars and artists who are writing quite explicitly about this idea of, you know, human exceptionalism being an untenable position in the present moment, and really saying that, oh, you know, everybody thinks the best thing is the biggest thing, or, you know, the elephant is the most remarkable, you know, creature in the natural kingdom. But let's look at the insects, because these insects live such complex, sophisticated social and intellectual lives of their own. And they're incredibly diverse, and they really challenge the notion that humans are the most complex creatures that God ever made. And that idea, you know, is something that shows up both among in the writings of Hufnagel's colleagues, but also shows up in later natural history treatises. So the first printed treatise on insects doesn't get published until the 17th century, but the writing of it began during Hufnagel's lifetime, and it makes precisely that argument. So it's really impossible to separate the kind of impulse to doubt the exceptionalism or the uniqueness or superiority of humankind. It's impossible to separate that impulse from the kind of radical change that Hufnagel and his colleagues experienced in the 16th century, you know, which was really the turning point toward a kind of the modern worldview that we still inhabit, you know, a shift away from a kind of hierarchical understanding of the world toward a more, you know, destructured, uncertain, and questioning way of understanding our relationship to the world around us. That said, I mean, the idea of human exceptionalism also goes back to antiquity. So Hufnagel and his colleagues were also picking up on ideas that they found in classical authors and in medieval texts as well. I opened the book actually with one of Hufnagel's contemporaries who was deeply engaged with the first book of Ovid's Metamorphoses, where Ovid describes the origins of the world, and he describes, you know, that the difference between the human and the animal world. And it's one of those moments where Hufnagel's contemporaries read this description of how humankind is unique in having the impulse to look up toward the heavens, to look up toward what we would now, you know, in a Christian context would be understood to be God. And And, you know, Hufnagel and his colleagues were like, well, wait a minute, you know, how unique are we? I mean, all of these creatures were part of God's creation. And so this relativity is really the kind of shift that happens in the 16th century, a relativity in the understanding of the relationship between the human and the natural world that, you know, stays with us still.
And this shift that's happening in the 16th century, this must tie into developments in entomology at the time and microscopy, which I believe developed, you note, in the 17th century. So I wondered how all of this relates to Hufnagel's works and what makes Ignis, this book of fire, really stand out among the volumes of the four elements and these insects that are so complicated and so marvelous and so small. How do they come to hold a pride of place among all of his other animal subjects?
Yes, we circled around this insect volume several times now. I mean, if there's something that people know about Joris Hufnagel, and let's be honest, Joris Hufnagel is not a household name. So if you haven't heard of him, it's not like you've been missing something profound here. You know, he's very little known, but in the sort of small circle of the academic world that I inhabit, if anybody had heard of Hufnagel, it was probably because of his representations of insects. And this has to do in part with the fact that they had a kind of reception in the history of art history because of that print series I mentioned earlier, produced by his son. And so if you look at 17th century still life paintings, representations of sort of bouquets of flowers, which are, you know, very common and popular in the 17th century, and you look at the insects represented in those still life paintings, you will find tons of insects that are just co-opted from those prints that Hufnagel's son produced. And even 17th century natural history treatises that are, you know, seem to be part of this kind of empirical project borrow representations of insects from Hufnagel. This is even after the advent of the invention of the microscope, which happens in the 17th century, and, you know, fuels a more detailed examination of insects and the sort of rise of modern entomology from the perspective of studying their reproduction, their structures, you know, the way that they work, the way that their bodies work. And that's not something that Hufnagel could do. He did not have access to the microscope in the 16th century. And he never could have anticipated that his images were to endure for so long as sort of as models for how to represent a diversity of insect specimens. What he did was, you know, in some ways really simple, which is that he, in his travels around Europe, because he only really represents European insects, he devised, probably through, you know, collaboration again with his network of colleagues, some of whom were also interested in insects and were engaged with the kind of remnants of Conrad Gesner's project to make an insect book. And he figured out clearly somehow how to create and preserve insect specimens so that he could represent them. Because obviously, if you're trying to represent a dragonfly, there's a beautiful miniature of a dragonfly on the cover of my book from Hufnagel's Ignis volume. You can't have that dragonfly be alive. You have to somehow take a dead specimen and have it preserved in such a careful way that you preserve its delicacy and you can then represent it in the slow, laborious process of making a watercolor or gouache miniature. So what Hufnagel does is a kind of very simple impulse. He's going to make a book of insects. He doesn't have any visual models, so he has to make his own. But then what he does with it is not simple at all, because another individual might have done that and put a single insect on each folio of the manuscript and sort of labeled, this is a dragonfly and this is a beetle. But Hufnagel created conversations across the specimens of the insect kingdom that he studied. So he has miniatures where he's fascinated by insect metamorphosis. And I argue in the book that when he looks at insects, he sees not only nature's smallest and most complex creations and sort of manifestations of divine artifice, he also sees the potential for change being built into nature, the potential for transformation that is a kind of leitmotif of his entire career. Another of his personal mottos that I discuss in the first chapter of the book is the Latin motto "Dum extendar," which means "until I am forged," by which Hufmannsthal meant quite literally that he was being beaten down. He was being beaten like a nail on an anvil by the kind of political and circumstances surrounding him, and that he was undergoing a process of constant change and transformation to adapt to those circumstances. So there are moments where he represents individual insect species, and he's showing us, you know, how a butterfly goes from the larva to its kind of adult state. And he's showing us insects from different sides. Sometimes you flip from one folio to another in the manuscript, and he'll show you the same insect flipping over from one folio to the next. So he's also interested in sort of reanimating these specimens on the page. And then there are moments, for instance, in his representation of the scarab beetle, which is an enormous beetle that was very common actually in Europe and especially in England, where Hufmannsthal also spent time. Particularly the female scarab beetle is very large, which I enjoy, much larger than the male. It's an insect that would take up your entire hand, a full grown female scarab beetle. And he represents the scarab beetle on a pose exactly like that of another of the 16th century artists who engaged in nature study, the great German Renaissance artist Albrecht Dürer, who had made a miniature of the scarab beetle back in the early 16th century, and Hufmannsthal clearly knew that model. But what's amazing about Hufmannsthal's scarab beetle is the way that he simultaneously references this idea of an artistic tradition in which he's participating, a kind of artistic engagement with the study of insects as sort of manifestations of divine artifice and sort of challenges to human artifice. And at the same time, Hufmannsthal shows us that he also studied a scarab beetle from life, because the shadow underneath the scarab beetle in Hufmannsthal's miniature, compared to that of Albrecht Dürer, who was a really fabulous artist, the shadow is so much more complex in depth and changes of tone, that he basically tells us with that shadow, without writing a single word on the page, that he was studying this thing from the life. And in some ways, he got it better than Dürer. So there's this simultaneously, there's simultaneous sense of humility toward the models of nature, the models of divine artifice. And at the same time, Hufmannsthal's saying that he knew he was pretty good. Here's the limit. Sort of, he might be able to surpass an earlier Renaissance artist, but he's not going to be able to surpass God, who created these things that are, in some ways, he feels really still beyond his understanding, no matter how beautifully he represents them.
There are a number of binaries which underpin the study of Hufmannsthal's works, and what you just mentioned about the dragonfly on the cover and that faint shadow, it's another example of something small having a large meaning, and Hufmannsthal attempting to bring this insect to life. It touches on another binary that I thought that we could briefly discuss, namely that of old and new. And I wondered, how does Hufmannsthal, during his process of creation as well as his final product, simultaneously rejuvenate that which he is memorializing, both in regards to his animal subjects as well as his home of Antwerp, which he often depicts?
Thank you, Akash. That's a beautiful question and a very complex one. I mean, I should say, you know, once I fell in love with Hufmannsthal's images and started to learn more about him, I realized I think it's okay to admit, even as a scholar, that I feel a tremendous kinship with Hufmannsthal as a thinker in the way that he engaged with his world and engaged with the making of art. Because he is somebody who does care deeply, precisely as you've observed, someone who does really care deeply about the past, who's trying to look forward to imagine a future, that he can't quite envision given the tremendous change surrounding him. But at the same time, he's interested in ancient texts. We have records that a Germany colleague of mine found in the libraries in Germany of him checking out books at the Munich Court Library, sort of reading all of these obscure, you know, what is it would seem to us very obscure sources in the process of producing manuscripts for the court. So he read voraciously. He was interested in the classical past, and this is something that I've written about. I wrote about the kind of interest in the classical past for my first book, which was on an artist from the early 16th century. And, you know, I think we can think about his understanding of, you know, old and new also in terms of Antwerp itself, which is a city that became a modern city in the early 16th century. I mean, its roads were redesigned to be grander. It was the kind of entrepot of 16th century Europe. It was the place people came to trade, to purchase art from all over Europe and even beyond. It's the place where Albrecht Dürer, who I just mentioned, who made that image of the scarab beetle, visited in the 1520s and saw, you know, remarkable things from all over different parts of the world. So he's part of this city that is simultaneously progressive, but then he sees the kind of moment of iconoclasm and the disruption brought on by the Dutch revolt and this fight against Spanish imperial rule. And he sees so many things that he understood to be progress destroyed. And so how do you situate yourself in relationship to that? There's a kind of longing that happens when something's gone that you always presume will be there. That's certainly something, once again, that I think in our present moment we can understand really well. I certainly never appreciated the privilege of visiting art museums so much until I was not able to go and visit them over the past few months here in the States. And so his, you know, his miniatures from late in his life clearly reflect his sort of thinking back to a past that has been lost, a historical moment in the history of the Netherlands, that a chapter that's closed, and thinking back to a place that he will never go back to. At the same time, as he's making his studies of the natural world, he's really pushing in a new direction. So, you know, there's a reason that in the 17th century, people Swammerdam, who's one of the microscopists in the 17th century Netherlands, who's engaged in the study of the reproduction of insects and doing really radical work. And, you know, he, you know, expresses his admiration for what Hufnagel did because Hufnagel was really pushing in a new direction. I mean, it's easy to look at Hufnagel's images and see the beginnings of a kind of empirical scientific representation. And we can see that in retrospect. And it's true, even though that's not what Hufnagel was trying to do. I mean, he made images that could function as scientific representations of insect specimens at the end of the 16th century, having no idea that that is how they might be seen centuries later. And I think that's really fascinating. And that's the part that is where we need his historical context to understand these images in full, because we can represent, appreciate them from one direction as innovative and forward moving, and at the same time understand the ways that Hufnagel was using the making of them, the process of creating these images, as a way of thinking about his own past, about the changes underway in his present, and sort of trying to imagine what the future for himself and his country and Europe at large might actually hold.
I see. Dr. Bass, it was a true pleasure reading your book, and thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. May I ask if you intend to continue researching animals in your future work or at some other time?
Well, first of all, thank you, Akash. It's been really a pleasure to speak with you. And I'm glad you asked, because I actually, as I was finishing the writing of this book, Insect Artifice, I was in Amsterdam on a fellowship at the Netherlands Institute for Advanced Study, And I went out for a happy hour with three of my colleagues, and we discovered in the process that we all shared a love of shells. And so actually, next year, I have a book forthcoming that's a co-authored book called Conchophilia, Shells, Art, and Curiosity in Early Modern Europe, that is all about sort of representation and collecting and engagement with shells in the period of the 16th through the 18th century. And I think it's going to be a really, really fun book.
I look very forward to reading it. Well, thank you, Dr. Bass, and thank you to our listeners. This has been part of the Animal Studies podcast series on the New Books Network. Dr. Bass's book is Insect Artifice, Nature and Art in the Detroit Volts, and it'll be listed on our podcast page.